From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The holidays leave many of us with more time to go to the movies and plenty of new movies to see. On today's Fresh Air, film critic John Powers talks with us about this year's crop of holiday releases, films that include Quentin Tarantino's Jackie Brown, Martin Scorsese's Kundun, and Woody Allen's Deconstructing Harry. Also, music critic Milo Miles recommends books for music lovers, and rock critic Ken Tucker reviews his pick for the best Christmas album of the year. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Authorities in Denver are negotiating with a gunman who's holding hostages at the city's main postal service facility. Teresa Schiavone of Colorado Public Radio reports.
A former postal employee is holding four hostages at an office inside Denver's main postal facility. The hostages are all postal employees. Police SWAT teams have surrounded the sorting facility and are negotiating with a gunman in an office in the building. A daycare center for employee children is reportedly out of harm's way. The postal center is the size of about 8 football fields. Many employees near the area where the hostages are being held have already been evacuated, but hundreds of others at the large postal complex are still apparently in the building. Roadways surrounding the post office have been closed, preventing any other employees or customers from nearing the mail center. For NPR News, I'm Teresa Schiavone in Denver.
Lawyers for Terry Nichols will be back in federal court in Denver today, asking the judge to rule out the death penalty as a punishment for their client. Nichols was convicted of conspiracy and manslaughter for his role in the Oklahoma City bombing. Defense attorney Michael Tiger will try to convince Judge Richard Mache that since Nichols was acquitted of first-degree murder charges, the death penalty should not be an option for the jury when it begins the punishment phase of the trial next Monday. In Mexico, authorities are questioning four possible suspects in connection with Monday's massacre in Chiapas. Survivors are blaming paramilitary forces for the attack. From Mexico City, the BBC's Emma Patterson has more.
Survivors of the massacre have described how they ran for their lives as a group of masked gunmen burst into their village. The paramilitaries, they say, opened fire indiscriminately. Among the victims were at least 15 children. Some were shot, others beaten to death, in a round of killing which lasted for more than 5 hours. The survivors are now seeking refuge in nearby communities. They say they're too afraid ever to return home. Witnesses say the gunmen were local members of the ruling Institutional Revolutionary Party. Party leaders have denied any involvement. But this latest attack is not without precedent. Pro-government paramilitary organizations have been blamed for a series of attacks during the past few months, most of them directed against the Zapatista rebels and their supporters.
The BBC's Emma Patterson reporting. Defense Secretary William Cohen has arrived in Tuzla in Bosnia to visit the thousands of American soldiers who are members of the peacekeeping force in Bosnia. Cohen and his wife are accompanied by singer Mary Chapin Carpenter. Cohen is also bearing gifts, including thousands of bags of microwave popcorn donated by Paul Newman's company. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down just over 16 points in light pre-holiday trading. On the NASDAQ, the composite index is down just over 5. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, trading is very light on Wall Street today because of the Christmas holiday. Yesterday was the last full trading session of the week. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
It's an abbreviated session, with the stock market closing at 1 p.m. Eastern, and trading in the Treasury market will finish at 2 o'clock. On the positive side, chemical stocks are advancing on expectations for strong fourth-quarter earnings. However, money center banks are lower after Schroeder & Company lowered its opinion of Citicorp on concern about the effects of Asian financial difficulties. At the same time, shares in roadway services have lost more than 15%, after the company cautioned that fourth quarter results will show modest improvement because of higher labor cost. I'm Doug Krisner.
New figures released this morning by the Commerce Department show the biggest gain in personal income in the U.S. in a year and a half, up 0.8% in November. But consumer spending rose only half as much. The report is another indication that consumers are not spending as much this holiday season as retailers had hoped. $10 billion in emergency loans pledged to South Korea are being speeded up so the money will be in place before the end of the year to help the Korean government avoid defaulting on debt payments. The loans include $2 billion from the International Monetary Fund and $8 billion from the group of seven industrialized countries, including the United States. In return, South Korea is agreeing to expedite financial reforms and to open its domestic industrial markets much sooner than originally planned. The country's finance minister says the infusion of money will greatly ease South Korea's currency and economic crisis. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 170 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. For many of us, the holiday season means more time to get to the movies. So we asked our film critic, John Powers, to talk with us about this year's crop of holiday releases. Some of the movies he'll talk about are opening in select cities for the holidays and will open more widely in January. I asked John first about the movie industry's holiday release strategy this year.
I think the strategy that defines this year's Christmas releases is a kind of corporate madness. On Christmas Day, there are several movies opening, probably five or six, and there are probably more good movies opening on that day than in the preceding 3 months. So what's happening is you have all these companies making these films that they clearly think are the best films they're making that year, and then opening them against one another so that at least half or more than half will be clear losers, will fail at the box office, and then people will wonder, like, why did they open it then?
What's the point of opening it on Christmas?
It's a prestigious date. What's happened in Hollywood is you really want the big opening day, and Christmas is a big movie-going day. And Christmas is also a prestige slot. It used to be that Christmas Day was the kind of thing where you'd do slightly unsavory pictures like Dirty Harry. You might open Dirty Harry on Christmas. But now it's a slot where you're putting movies that you consider to be high-class movies. So you actually have, you know, a film about the Dalai Lama opening on Christmas Day. You have the new Quentin Tarantino movie opening on Christmas Day. You have the new James Brooks movie opening on Christmas Day. You have a foreign film that many people think is like going to be the most popular foreign film of the year opening on Christmas Day.
So I used to think it was only Jews, agnostics, and antisocial people who went to the movies on Christmas Day.
No. In fact, I think that what happens is, Even for Christians, the question is, what do you do after 4 o'clock? And the answer is, you go off to the movies.
Okay, well, let's start with some of the films opening on Christmas Day. Let's start with Quentin Tarantino's new film, Jackie Brown. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the story first, and then we'll talk about it as a movie.
Okay, yeah, the Quentin Tarantino film, Jackie Brown, is based on an Elmore Leonard novel called A Rum Punch. And it's basically a story about three or four people. One of them is a gunrunner named Ordell. He's played by Samuel Jackson. He's a gunrunner who uses a stewardess, a low-level stewardess named Jackie Brown, played by Pam Grier, to carry money from him to and from Mexico. She gets caught by the cops carrying this money, and she goes to a bail bondsman named Max Cherry. He's played by Robert Forster, who you might remember from the old movie Medium Cool and some very bad television series. And what happens is you develop a relationship where Jackie Brown is trying to play both the cops and the gunrunner off against one another in order to survive for herself. The evil gunrunner is killing people along the way, and Max Cherry, the bail bondsman, kind of falls in love with Jackie Brown, and he's trying to protect her.
Now, how does Jackie Brown compare in style and attitude to Pulp Fiction?
Well, I think that what's interesting about Jackie Brown is it's a movie that is going to get a lot of reviews saying it's a disappointing movie. And they're going to be using the success of Pulp Fiction to thump it. I think it's actually one of the peculiar things that's happened in American culture is if you make something that people really love, the next time you make something, they make you pay for it by actually thumping you with what you've done before. What Jackie Brown does is basically take a lot of the things that were in Pulp Fiction, it's a crime story, blah, 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 but it sort of turns it inside out so that whereas Pulp Fiction was hip and young and fast, for instance, Jackie Brown is not hip. It's not young. It's not fast. It doesn't resurrect big stars like John Travolta, but kind of small-time favorites of Tarantino like Robert Forster and Pam Grier. You know, whereas Pulp Fiction was sort of moved along by the threat of impending violence, Jackie Brown isn't particularly violent, and the violence is very, very muted. The scenes aren't carried by our fear that somebody's going to get killed. Quite the contrary, what Tarantino does is he takes these small character scenes with people just sort of sitting around talking and milks them and milks them and milks them. And I think, you know, many of the scenes are just supremely funny. I mean, it's a movie that I could watch over and over again because there are so many wonderful little bits, character bits in the movie. There's a scene early on where Robert De Niro, who plays Sam Jackson's sidekick, Sam Jackson and Bridget Fonda, who plays Jackson's mistress, are sort of sitting around Jackson's apartment. And the whole question is going to be, who's going to answer the telephone? And it's a power struggle between Jackson and his girlfriend. And it has to do with, like, the dope that Bridget Fonda is always smoking. And it becomes this very funny, kind of almost like Beckett-like sequence, where you're watching these lowlifes discussing the smallest possible things. The movie is filled with character moments like that, which are extraordinarily funny, sharply observed, beautifully directed. In lots of ways, Jackie Brown is a better-made movie than Pulp Fiction.
Tarantino resurrected a lot of great old records for Pulp Fiction. How are the records in Jackie Brown?
Well, the records in Jackie Brown, I think, are, I guess to begin with, they're blacker. I mean, you know, I think one of the striking features of Jackie Brown is that it's sort of an art film version of a blaxploitation movie. Tarantino is a great fan of the kind of movies like Foxy Brown and stuff that came out, which were basically sold as sort of crime action pictures to black audiences in the 70s. Tarantino loves those movies, and this film is kind of an art film homage to that.
I would guess that the budget is bigger for this new movie than what Tarantino had to work with in Pulp Fiction. Has that... Sometimes a bigger budget throws people off.
Yes. Well, what's curious is the budget on this film isn't bigger than the budget for Pulp Fiction. You know, he made it for $12 million.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what's intelligent about him is this is a person who, after Pulp Fiction, could have gone to any studio and said, I need $100 million to make a movie. And any studio would have given it to him. And I think what he prefers to do is to have control, the control that comes with making a movie that's cheap enough, that's certain to make money. Because I think what he's trying to do with this movie, leaving aside the character study aspect of the film, is I think he's trying to position himself in a way so that he no longer actually has to keep making crime movies. And this is a movie when you watch that has so much funny stuff, there's some very nice ardent stuff between Pam Grier and Robert Forster, that you realize this is a guy who could make a comedy. He could actually make a romance. He could make an adventure movie. It shows that he's not just a guy who can do kind of hip hitmen killing people. He doesn't need to do that. He's moved beyond that, and this movie proves it.
Oh, good. Another movie opening Christmas Day is Kundun, Martin Scorsese's new movie about the young Dalai Lama, the Dalai Lama's life until the point when he was forced into exile out of Tibet. What's the mood and atmosphere of this movie like?
It's actually a very poetic movie. And I think somehow when you use the term poetic to describe a Hollywood film, you know that that means most people aren't going to like it. Basically, it's the story, you know, of the young Dalai Lama. And it sort of follows his life through, sort of showing the transformation of his life from being a small boy who suddenly discovered and turned into the Dalai Lama through the moment when he has to flee Tibet, fleeing the Chinese soldiers. And so, like, it more or less captures about 20 years of his life. And it's about both his transformation, but also what happens when this kind of small, inward-looking, very nonviolent country suddenly enters history. You know, the Chinese decide that they own Tibet. They come in, and you have the clash between the highly ritualized culture of Tibet and the much more modern 20th century culture of communist China. And the thing that's interesting, I guess, about the film is that in story terms, it frankly isn't very interesting. I think the script isn't particularly interesting. And there's a real problem at the heart of the movie, which is that Buddhists and Buddhism don't make for very dramatic stuff. So in the course of the film, we watch the young boy, who's the Dalai Lama, go through various stages of growth. And initially, he's kind of feisty little kid, you know, kind of rebellious and fun-loving. And gradually, as he becomes more and more Dalai Lama-like, he becomes slightly more mellowed out, more accepting, and he's no longer the dramatic figure he was before. Because it's almost like the very nature of Buddhism to not be dramatic. So in the second half of the movie, when the Dalai Lama is more grown up, he's the least expressive that he's been at any point in the movie, because in fact, he has learned to take on the Buddhist ideas about how you deal with suffering, pain, and loss, and so forth.
So, John, fair to say you like the movie?
Well, I do like the movie, but I must warn viewers that many of them will find it boring. The first half is really terrific. The second half seems like you're getting a lot of the same stuff over and over again, and there's no real dramatic build. It's a historical accurate film. If you like good filmmaking, I think you will love the movie. What's really impressive about this movie is that it manages to somehow capture certain parts of, like, the Buddhist way of looking at the world. There's the closing scene where you watch the Dalai Lama fleeing to basically the border of Tibet in order to escape the Chinese, kind of blends past, present, and future visually in a way that I've never quite seen in a movie. I mean, that at the level of sort of poetic filmmaking where almost everything is done by suggestion rather than by overt statement, It's wonderful. If I can just compare it in a small way to Jackie Brown, one of the things about Jackie Brown that's very nice is that Tarantino is an extraordinarily good director. That movie begins with Jackie Brown on an airport runway. You see her in profile being carried to her miserable job by one of those moving ramps in an airport. The movie ends, and I'm not giving anything away, with Jackie Brown behind the wheel of a car driving toward us. And simply in the visual idea that we see how she's been carried from a passive person who's going unhappily to a person who's basically behind the wheel. Similarly, in the film that Scorsese has made, he uses the visual imagery, the ritualized aspects of Tibet, in a kind of way to suggest everything visually and poetically rather than just through simple story and plot terms.
So how's Robert De Niro as the Dalai Lama? Only kidding. I guess De Niro's not in that movie.
No, he's not. But what I would say, and this might even get us into the next film, is that De Niro is having a really good Christmas. He's extremely funny as a kind of stoner ex-con in Jackie Brown. He's incredibly relaxed, and he's also very funny in the movie Wag the Dog, which is one of the other Christmas releases, where he plays a kind of heightened version of someone like Dick Morris or James Carville, a presidential advisor who's brought in to work magic at election time.
Well, that's good, because I think in some ways De Niro has fallen into basic shticks that you see recurring in role after role.
Yeah, I think what's curious is that he, like Tarantino and Scorsese and a lot of other people, are kind of prisoners of, like, the greatness trap. You know, I was talking with a friend, and we were discussing how hard it must be to be Martin Scorsese, where every time you make a movie, people are thinking, is this a masterpiece?
Right.
Yes. No, after Pulp Fiction, whatever movie Tarantino made was going to be judged by that standard rather than by the standard of all the other movies that are coming out. And so that happens with him. De Niro gave all these legendary performances in his younger years, and it's really hard for him, I think, sometimes to relax in a film and just have a good time, because he seems to be reprising In these bigger roles, he seems to be reprising old bits. But there's got to be a kind of weird tension involved in all of that.
Well, tell us more about the political satire of Wag the Dog.
Yes. Wag the Dog is a kind of glibly cynical political satire that I thought was very funny. It basically, the premise is quite simple. It's 2 weeks before election time, and a Girl Scout has accused the sitting president of more or less coming on to her in the White House, trying to find some sort of way of saving the president's election campaign. The character played by Robert De Niro is brought in, and his idea is to stage a phony war, basically for television, because Americans are such suckers that whenever you stage a war, Americans always pull behind it. So there's actually a fake war set up with Albania, and more or less there's no real war that's actually happening, but the staging of the war is given over to a Hollywood producer played by Dustin Hoffman. And what happens is the whole film is basically the working out of the idea of how you stage a phony war for the media in order to get a president reelected. That's the satirical idea, which isn't really a profound satirical idea. Nevertheless, a lot of the detail work in the film is extremely, extremely funny.
Dustin Hoffman is one of the stars of it. I really prefer Dustin Hoffman in comedies nowadays, when part of what is being mocked is his ego, in a way, his greatness.
Yes, well, I think one of the funny things is that from the beginning, Dustin Hoffman was always great at comedy. And he seemed to have gotten away from it. But if you actually look at the roles that probably most people love him for, The Graduate, Tootsie, and probably this. Those are the cases where he's very good at simultaneously, you know, he has great comic timing to begin with. I should just start off by saying very few actors in Hollywood can deliver a line right on the button the way Dustin Hoffman can. When you go see Wag the Dog, there are certain moments where he, as the producer, he's going to a kind of producer shtick, and the lines he's delivering aren't that funny, but Hoffman delivers them so completely and absolutely perfectly, the scene becomes extraordinarily funny. I mean, he's a great comic actor, and this is a wonderful role. I mean, Hollywood insiders know he's sending up this famous producer named Robert Evans, but you don't really need to know the specific person he's sending up to, in order to enjoy the movie. It's just a wonderful portrait of a Hollywood guy who loves being able to do stuff, manipulate stuff, make it all work, and whose vanity is such that he's the only person who can do this. That His vanity is such that he can do this stuff, and his pain in life is that no one recognizes that he's the real creator behind movies, or in this case, behind wars.
My guest is Fresh Air's film critic and film critic for Vogue magazine, John Powers. We're talking about movies opening for the holidays. John, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
This is Fresh Air. Back with Fresh Air film critic John Powers, who's also film critic for Vogue magazine, and we're talking about some of the movies opening for the holidays. Well, we have another big actor in a holiday release, and that's Jack Nicholson in the comedy As Good As It Gets, which is directed by James Brooks, who, I think he co-created the Mary Tyler Moore Show, yes?
Yes.
And the Tracy Ullman Show, and Broadcast News he directed, and Terms of Endearment. So how's As Good As It Gets?
Well, what's funny about As Good As It Gets is that, you know, it's been nominated for lots of Golden Globes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was at the LA Film Critics meeting, it got lots of votes for various things. And yet I think it's a terrible, terrible movie.
Mm.
It's basically, it has sort of like a strong hook. Jack Nicholson plays this obsessive compulsive guy named Melvin. He's a writer who, in addition to being obsessive compulsive, is just a nasty SOB. You know, he makes racist remarks. He makes anti-Semitic remarks. He makes homophobic remarks. The movie begins with him taking his neighbor's dog and dropping it down the trash chute, okay, in the apartment building. I mean, he's a bad guy. That's sort of a promising idea because you can imagine Jack Nicholson playing a really bad guy. But what happens over the course of the movie is that he has to be softened, and he more or less learns to love life. He learns to love life partly through his gay neighbor, an artist played by Greg Kinnear, but in particular by his love for his favorite waitress, played by Helen Hunt. And gradually this whole thing is this working out whereby Melvin becomes humanized and learns to love. It's the kind of story, I think, that Hollywood people really love. But when you watch it, what's shocking is how completely incoherent it is at every level. I mean, James Brooks, you know, who did make Terms of Endearment and Broadcast News, used to have sort of like a proficient style. This movie is so badly lit, so badly shot, so incoherently directed, it's the equivalent of an ungrammatical sentence. When you're watching it, you can't believe that a movie that costs this much money and has so many professionals could just be so sloppy at the technical level. But beyond that, what's really striking is that the movie makes no dramatic or logical sense in terms of the characters. As you're watching, Nicholson's character starts off a rat, then is transformed not by anything that actually is in his character, but by the needs of the script.
What have you thought of Nicholson's recent performances? He's really among, you know, although he plays miserable human beings often in his movies, he's one of the more beloved great actors in America. What have you thought of his recent work?
You know, well, I think that, you know, that Nicholson's great problem is that the world loves him most when he's doing Jack. You know, when he really tries to act in movies like Hoffa, the audience tends not to go. Whereas if he's sort of doing the familiar Jack Nicholson thing, people tend to really like him. And in the case of his recent work, a lot of it, I think, hasn't been very interesting or very ambitious. I think he's really trying very hard in As Good As It Gets. But I think what's happened is that the director, James Brooks, is so unclear about how to play the story that Nicholson's performance at certain points is really great and at other points rings completely false. But you can't tell whether that's Nicholson because the character doesn't make any sense as it's written. And I think Brooks kind of shies away from the implications of what he's done. So that I think this is the only movie I've ever seen where Jack Nicholson is giving invective and you don't believe him. And I think it's partly because he's saying such anti-Semitic, racist, and homophobic things at the beginning of the film that Brooks kind of backed away and maybe chose the takes that are less powerful for fear that he seems so rotten at the beginning that we won't love him at the end.
How's Helen Hunt in the movie? Most people know her now through Mad About You.
Helen Hunt is a good, solid television actress. And I think her performance here is a good, solid TV performance. You know, there's not much depth to the character. It's a badly underwritten character. I mean, her major character quality, besides decency, is that she's a single mom with a son with a lung problem. You know, so starting, that's her character. She does a rather nice job of fleshing it out in a kind of, I think, sort of sitcom way. She's a very soothing and pleasant presence in the movie. I wouldn't say it's a great performance, and I think it's one measure of how bad the women's roles are this year that she's actually being up for all sorts of awards.
John Powers is Fresh Air's film critic and film critic for Vogue. We'll continue our look at holiday releases in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Bill Withers as featured on the soundtrack of Jackie Brown.
A man we passed just tried to stare me down. And when I looked at you, you looked at the ground. I don't know who he is, but I think that you do. Dadgummit, who is he and what is he to you? I had something in my heart and in your eyes. Tell me he's not someone just passing by. And when you cleared your throat, was that your cue? Dadgummit, who is he and what is he to you? Now when I add the sum of you and me, I get confused and I keep coming up with three.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we look at more new movies with film critic John Powers. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews what he considers this year's best Christmas record, and music critic Milo Miles recommends books for music lovers.
He's got a beard that's long and white.
Santa's got a beard that's long and white.
Who comes around on a special night?
Santa comes around on a special night.
Special night, beard that's white.
Must be Santa, must be Santa, must be Santa, Santa Claus.
Who wears boots and a suit of red?
Santa wears boots and a suit of red.
Who wears a long cap on his head?
Santa wears a long cap on his head.
Cap on head, suit that's red.
Special night, beard that's white.
Red cherry nose.
Santa's got a big red cherry nose.
Who laughs this way? Ho, ho, ho.
Santa laughs this way. Ho, ho, ho.
Ho, ho, ho. Cherry nose. Cap on head. Suit that's red. Special night. Beard that's white.
Must be Santa.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with our film critic, John Powers. We're talking about new movies opening for the holidays. Some of the films are opening only in selected cities now and will open widely after the new year. There's a new movie starring Daniel Day-Lewis, directed by Jim Sheridan, who also directed Daniel Day-Lewis in The Name of the Father. This is called The Boxer. What's it about, John?
Well, you know, it's tempting to say, and probably even accurate to say, that it is the generic Northern Ireland movie. Daniel Day-Lewis plays an ex-IRA guy who's in prison for a while because of an act he'd committed, who gets out and comes back to his old neighborhood. And essentially, he wants to get out of the violence of the IRA. And at the same, and so he sets up a kind of boxing club for the local kids. It's going to be non-sectarian. At the same time, he wants to get involved with his old girlfriend, played by Emily Watson, who is in Breaking the Waves. But the problem is, while he was in jail, she married somebody else. And IRA rules are such that if you are an IRA wife and your husband's in prison, if you mess around, you're dead. The problem with the film is that you feel as if you're seeing the IRA slash Protestant violence issue being treated yet again, and somehow there isn't quite enough variation in that story for the film itself to feel really fresh. Yet the strange thing about it is it's probably the best directing that Jim Sheridan has ever done. I mean, the film is beautifully lit, the timing is right, all the performances are extraordinarily good. You know, Daniel Day-Lewis is simply a wonderful actor, and he's really good in this film. I don't think it's his greatest performance, but it's one of the best performances of the year. Emily Watson as the girlfriend is an extraordinary actress. I think she's gotten an underwritten role. I mean, as with most women's roles, it's underwritten. She spends a lot of the movie going, "Oh, Donnie, oh, Donnie." Nevertheless, she goes, "Oh, Donnie," really well. It's a very, very good performance. And in fact, a lot of the secondary characters, you know, the kind of angry IRA people who simply can't bear the thought of not getting revenge for the last killing, you know, are extraordinarily well done. So it's actually a strong, intelligent, good movie, I think, whose only failing is that if you've seen In the Name of the Father or Some Mother's Son or lots of the other films about this subject, you feel like you've sort of done it. And at the same time, I mean, it's a good, solid piece of filmmaking.
Okay. Woody Allen has a movie opening for the holidays called Deconstructing Harry, which is about a writer who writes a novel based on a lot of people who he knows, and they all get really angry at him for the way he's portrayed them. How does people are so ambivalent about Woody Allen now? You know, they're really angry and disgusted with the man, but still really interested in his movies. And so, when you see a Woody Allen movie now, you always kind of read it as the kind of secret story of his life to try to get more inside his head. So, how does like the man and the movie come together in this one?
Well, I think it's actually, and it is the interesting Woody Allen problem, is now he's every protagonist in every movie he makes. But, you know, that when you see the movie, you are thinking, what is Woody saying about Woody? In this particular case, he's playing a character who I think on paper might have been the meanest character Allen has ever made. I mean, he basically is, you know, curses at women. He's lonely. He's dishonest. He's shifty. He's a betrayer. He's not a nice guy. And more or less in writing his fiction, based on his life, he's so irresponsible that, you know, for example, if he's had an affair with a married woman, he will make it so transparent in the novel who it is that it destroys her life, and he has no qualms about that. I mean, he's not a pleasant guy, and you know, it's the whole film is basically about, I think, the gap between trying to live a decent life as a person and at the same time create good art. You know, one of the sad truths I think that anybody who's ever met artists realize is that there's no automatic connection between virtue and talent. And the character Harry in this particular film is a guy who's basically, as he puts it, you know, good at art and bad at life.
Did you like the movie?
Actually, I don't like the movie at all. It's gotten extremely good reviews. A lot of people feel as though Allen has actually sort of taken a trenchant look at partly himself, but also this issue about art and life, and that it's him being more honest and creating a character who's darker, more negative, and less likable than ever before. Yet, strangely enough, I think that that's what the film pretends to be, but actually isn't. I think the film of his that actually is the dark film is Stardust Memories. In that film, the Allen character is genuinely unlikable. He dislikes his fans, and he hates himself. In this particular film, there's a weird way that even when Harry's being monstrous, it's always cute. that there are moments when he's calling women vile names where the audience laughs because it all has the rhythm of a joke. That at this point, Alan, I think, no longer knows how to play someone who isn't wooing the audience with his one-liners and his particular kind of charm. So that as I was watching the film, I was thinking, this is kind of a pseudo-examination of an unlikable character. You know, in Alan's defense, he didn't want to play the lead role himself. I think Elliot Gould pulled out at the last minute. I think Richard Dreyfuss turned it down. So it was, but the effect of having Alan in this film is that it seems like the usual Woody Allen thing, where the character's kind of neurotic, selfish, and rotten, albeit more rotten than usual, but at the same time, essentially the person we're with in the film. And then it has all the other kind of annoying recent Woody Allen things of, you know, it has what the critic Jim Hoberman called, you know, the ingenue du jour. In this case, Elizabeth Shue, who's the person who gets who's lucky enough to get to kiss Woody. I mean, last year it was Julia Roberts. You know, the year before that was Mira Sorvino, I believe. You know, there's always some young babe who inexplicably is attracted to Woody Allen.
When I saw The Coming Attractions about a week ago in a movie theater, the woman behind me was saying, "It was funny when he was young. It's not funny anymore."
Yes. Well, I think what's interesting is that there's a strange way that I was talking to a woman friend of mine who said to me of As Good As It Gets, Jack Nicholson doesn't wind up with Helen Hunt, does he? There is, I think, in the society now, finally beginning to dawn on people that some of these pairings are slightly unsavory. You know, I remember, you know, years ago when Gene Wilder was with Mary Stuart Masterson, and he looked so much older, you know, that my flesh just crawled. You know, it wanted to run out of the theater, you know, leaving my body there. And that happens over and over again. Because let's face it, we're not, you know, Woody Allen and Elizabeth Shue is not the same pairing as Cary Grant and Audrey Hepburn. I mean, Cary Grant, I think, in addition to being Cary Grant, knew when to get out. He knew the moment when suddenly it was too much to put him with younger women, whereas a lot of actors today don't.
My guest is Fresh Air's film critic, John Powers. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is John Powers, Fresh Air's film critic and film critic for Vogue magazine, and we're talking about some of the holiday movies. John, there's a lot of other movies that are either just opening or have already opened just in time for the holidays. So let's take a quick look at some of those. I'm interested in getting your thoughts. Let's start with Good Will Hunting. And this is a film that was co-written by the star of the new John Grisham movie.
Yes, but it was co-written by Matt Damon, who started in and who actually stars in Good Will Hunting, and by his friend Ben Affleck, who some of you will know is the star of Chasing Amy. Basically, it's a kind of wish fulfillment movie in a sense. It's about a young working class guy who's kind of a street tough, but who's also as brilliant as Einstein or Mozart. And the film it starts off rather well with showing his life on the streets, and then gradually, I think, turns into a rather simplistic and pat kind of touchy-feely, Healy thing. You know, Will Hunting is the character's name, played by Damon. And this young genius, you know, needs to be somehow socialized. And the way that happens is he's introduced to a kind of slightly, you know, dissident, disenchanted psychotherapist played by Robin Williams. And through a course of conversation, the two of them kind of smooth Will out and sort of prepare him for life. And so it's, you know, very much something like, say, Ordinary People.
Yes, I was thinking this should be called Extraordinary People.
Yes, it's Extraordinary People, which would actually be a great title. There's, you know, I mean, it's going to do very well. I wouldn't be surprised to see it win Oscars, or certainly get Oscar nominations, because the kind of instinctive worship of therapy that that Hollywood is known for, you know, is touched perfectly by this film, which also has all sorts of other things, you know, going for it. You know, Robin Williams, although he's played this role a zillion times, actually is better in this than he usually is. I mean, he's actually doing this role rather well. It's just you've seen it so many times that it doesn't seem so fresh. The young actor Matt Damon is really terrific in the movie, and as is often the case, it's enough to carry a movie to have the lead performance be extremely good. And Matt Damon's extremely good in the movie.
What do you think of The Sweet Hereafter, the new movie based on a Russell Banks novel and directed by Adam Ogoyan, who directed Exotica?
Well, see, I have a deep ambivalence about The Sweet Hereafter. It's one of those movies that I don't particularly warm to or like. And yet, at the same time, I can actually see that it's a very well-made movie that lots of my friends really love. And so it's one of those complicated cases where I don't like something, yet I suspect it's good. It's about a lawyer who comes to a small town where the town is still reeling from a school bus crash that's killed a bunch of the kids. And he basically tries to get people to do a class action suit on the grounds that more or less, there's no such thing as an accident. You know, we have to send a message, we have to get money, that somehow it isn't just an accident that this school bus went off the road and plunged into the water, killing the kids. So he's offering a kind of divine justice, which is what people often want in a case like this, because it's so unbearable, the thought that something could just happen accidentally. And basically, this is the story of this guy and this town dealing with this tragedy.
It's some excellent acting in it. Really terrific performances.
There's some terrific performances in it. And the thing about it is, there is something very harrowing in the entire idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that I think anybody who has kids, or anyone they love in the world, can't help but be haunted by the idea of how easily you can lose them. And one of the really brilliant things in the film, perhaps the best single thing in the film, is the way Ogoyan stages the fatal bus crash, because whereas a Hollywood director would play it up and make it big, what he does is he makes it seem so simple and accidental, you know, that one moment things are fine, the next moment it's not, and all of a sudden the people are dead. And the sheer terrifying matter-of-factness of the bus crash, you know, I think puts a chill in almost anybody, as does the sense of, like, how do you deal with the incredible pain of losing someone and not being able to do anything about it? Because I do think that, you know, in our modern world, there is that, as people get, or as maybe as people's sense of divine intervention is something that people hold to less, there's a real question of, like, how you make sense of something terribly tragic. And what's smart in the movie is the way that the Ian Holm character, who's the lawyer who comes to town to try to file a suit against the school bus company and all the rest, is the way he plays on that and suggests that basically the only way you can get justice is through money. So there's even a comment, I think, on how capitalism deals with tragedy, which is that the only way you can actually get satisfaction is by being paid.
A movie opening in select cities, as they like to say, for the holidays, is Afterglow, a new movie by Alan Rudolph, which stars Nick Nolte. And what do you think of this one?
Well, actually, I think it has an extremely bad opening half hour that made me want to walk out and then got quite wonderful. It's a sort of moody, poetic story of basically two couples, both of whom are trying to deal with sort of like the afterglow of love, the moment when the passion has gone, but you now, and the initial romance has faded, but now you have the rest of your life to love the person. And so it's a film about that afterglow of love. What I would want to single out in the film is there's a luminous performance by Julie Christie, who plays a kind of washed-up B-movie actress who is more or less unhappily married to Nick Nolte and who is incredibly saddened because their teenage daughter ran off from them. But it's the kind of performance that I think that older performers sometimes get when they are so capable of expressing deep emotion while seeming to do almost nothing. Young actors and actresses often tend to be all over the place, like really showing the emotion. Whereas Christie here is, you know, it's kind of almost a zen performance. She does almost nothing, yet she holds the entire movie together. It's incredibly moving and powerful. She seems sharp-edged without doing much. She's still quite lovely. She just holds the movie together. It's a very charismatic performance that, in fact, won the New York Film Critics Award for Best Actress of the Year. I mean, it's the kind of film, or the kind of performance, that takes a film that isn't quite certain of its tone at always and gives it this incredible emotional depth so that, you know, people are extremely moved by the film, as I was.
Well, all in all, it sounds like a pretty decent holiday season for movies. I remember one recent Christmas week where I spent day after day going from one bad movie to another. I even forget what the movies were. I just remember that terrible aftertaste that each of them gave me.
Yes, well, I think what's funny is, you know, that although Titanic isn't a great movie, for instance, it really is something, you know, that it will hold your attention for its full running time. It really is a Hollywood spectacle. And, you know, often, you know, at Christmas time, you get something that's supposed to be delivering what Hollywood can, and there's nothing to it. But movies like Titanic really do deliver it. You know, as a sort of spiritual Christmas movie, you know, Kundun really does deliver. If you're actually looking for a hilariously funny crime picture, Jackie Brown really does do it. Wag the Dog really is a funny political satire. I mean, satire almost never, you know, gets made in Hollywood, and here's one that's really, really funny. So in the sense that, I guess what I'm trying to say is that this really is a sort of special Christmas, because most of the films that are coming out are quite enjoyable.
Well, John, I want to wish you good holidays, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year.
Thank you.
I look forward to more reviews on Fresh Air, and happy holidays.
Okay, thank you.
John Powers is film critic for Fresh Air and Vogue. Milo Miles usually reviews music for Fresh Air, but today he reviews three books for music lovers.
Sometimes you have to play with your toys for a while before you recommend them to the other kids. That has certainly been my experience with the very big and fat Rough Guide to World Music and its new, somewhat smaller but still hefty cousin, The Rough Guide to Reggae. The Guide to World Music bumps 700 pages with entries from more than 50 contributors. As any such effort done by human beings would have to, it falls short. The writing is uneven. There's nothing approaching a coherent point of view about all the various styles. And you get a sneaky sense that some areas, like Greece and the Arab Middle East, get the too quick once over. But The Rough Guide to World Music just keeps piling up the descriptions and lively photos and discographies. The editors also have a sharp sense of just who is important enough for a page or two of individual profile. The guide defines loads of terms and explains just enough history. If you'd just gotten interested in the wondrous Pakistani singer Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan before he died this year, The Rough Guide will fill you in. If you want a thumbnail history of the 1960s MPB movement in Brazil, it's here. With a couple of years to use this tome, I find I reach for it frequently, and it has no serious competition. The Rough Guide to Reggae is more out on its own than one might imagine. Other than a Guinness book that's mostly a string of biographies, this is the only comprehensive survey of Jamaican pop I know of. It was written by Peter Dalton and Steve Barrow, who assembled the impeccable Tougher Than Tough anthology a couple years ago. The Rough Guide to Reggae is a sort of print equivalent to that box set, and Barrow's ear for the punchy tune serves him well in both cases. The book contains a perfectly decent run-through of the Bob Marley saga, but that isn't what's important about it. You need Barrow and Dalton to guide you through the thickets of dub reggae and to differentiate between the many fleeting stars of ragga and dancehall styles. Barrow is a guy who studied the Jamaican music industry and listened to more reggae records than any of us will ever have time for, and he knows where the tunes are. Although the illustrations in the Rough Guides are evocative, they're tiny. Val Wilmer's radiant black and white photos in the book Portrait of the Blues show just how glorious a good-sized shot can be. Wilmer's pictures range from the early 60s to the late 80s. She includes street scenes, dancing fans, and many blues performers. These can be famous or obscure, at work on stage, rolling on the road, or relaxing at home. All of them reflect Wilmer's ability to make the down-home look epic. A woman and her child at a jukebox have the grace of everyday royalty. Portrait of the Blues is subtitled America's Blues Musicians in Their Own Words, and the book's most vivid language comes from the lengthy musician quotes. For instance, bandleader Lowell Fulson's description of a Southern sheriff harassing his tour bus unfolds with as much tension and cunning as any of his songs. Portrait of the Blues would make a fine centerpiece for any roadhouse library.
Milo Miles is the music features editor for Soundstone.com. He reviewed The Rough Guide to World Music, The Rough Guide to Reggae, and Portrait of the Blues, America's Blues Musicians in Their Own Words.
Thank you. sentimental. No dejes cascabelito de repiquetear. En cada Navidad él vuelve a sonar. Cascabelito, cascabelero,
campanita de Navidad.
Por ser tan lindo es que yo te quiero.
Campanita de Navidad.
Alegrando a toda mi América.
Campanita de Navidad.
Saludando.
That's Ruben Blades and Yomo Toro. Coming up, Christmas music from teen sensation Hanson. This is Fresh Air. Every year brings a new spate of rock and roll Christmas collections, and this year's offerings range from RuPaul to New Age pianist Jim Brickman. Rock critic Ken Tucker says there's only a couple of worthwhile entries this year. The best among them is a CD from teen sensation Hanson.
Hanson, those three dorky cute brothers from Oklahoma, have already put out one of the year's most amusing and lively releases, their accurately named debut collection, Middle of Nowhere. What that record suggested was that these teeny boppers possess an appreciation for blue-eyed soul music that really pays off on their new Christmas album called Snowed In. Did I say soul? Here are 16-year-old Isaac, 14-year-old Taylor, and 11-year-old drummer boy Zachary tearing through an old chestnut, What Christmas Means to Me, done Motown style. The opposite end of this spectrum is the new CD from country singer Dwight Yoakam. It's called Come On Christmas, as if Christmas was pulling Dwight's leg or something. On most of the collection, Yoakam sounds as if he's one of those millions of people who are reported to contemplate suicide on major holidays.
Come on Christmas, please take me away. Keep me hidden safe till January's second day. Come on Christmas, come on nowhere. I'll wrap myself up in the cheer that's so abundant this time of year. Come on
Oh my gosh, that was such a downer. We need more Hanson right this instant. Here they are beating the elderly Beach Boys at their own game, wailing away on Brian Wilson's Little Saint Nick. The yardstick by which all rock holiday albums are measured is, of course, Phil Spector's Christmas Gift to You, released nigh on 30 years ago now. If Hanson doesn't yet possess the emotional maturity to match a Spector vocalist like Darlene Love, these boys do bring to the rock and roll Christmas genre a renewed sense of freshness, and even more rare, an underlying faith. Homeschooled evangelical Christians, they benefit from sincerity and a refreshing lack of irony. Like a lot of teeny bopper acts, Hanson may fade away in the next year, but they've already left behind some music that will stand the test of pop radio and many Christmases to come.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Roberta Shurrock, with Monique Nazareth, Kathy Wolf, and Lauren Krenzel. Alan Tu directed the show. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross. Merry Christmas from all of us at Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Remy Martin, Cognac, France, since 1724. Information available, 800-678-REMY. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Rosemary Clooney starred in the 1954 film White Christmas. On our Christmas edition of Fresh Air, we have a concert and interview with Rosemary Clooney. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
A foggy day in London town had me low and had me down.